Chapter 4. The Lure of Revelation.
"We have been hailed,"
Stennius said when the lion returned to the bridge, "by a frigate of the 10th Legion." The lion gazed at the ship visible in the oculus.
"You've its identity?"
"We have. It's the Sthalenus, a vessel of the 85th Clan Company."
The frigate's shape was battered. It looked like an ancient iron ingot, eroded and gnawed by rust and time. The hull was scarred by lasburns and patched repairs over torpedo hits. Some of its cannon batteries were gone, leaving behind wounds like broken teeth. The architecture of the upper hull was not much more than a functional ruin, yet the ship still conveyed the strength of a clenched fist. It was bloodied, but had not fallen. The lion thought of the iron hands he had encountered on Macragge. They bore the loss of Ferus Manus and the shattering of their legion with a mix of stoicism and brooding, vengeful silence. And those were the fortunate ones. They had reached Ultramar. They could become part of a multi-legion alliance against Horus. This ship was alone. Its warriors must have been fighting a war of skirmishes since Istvan V. The lion doubted they had had any chance of resupply. Their survival was impressive.
"Captain Calibus has asked to be received," Stennius went on.
"We will welcome him and his escort aboard," the lion said, "with all due ceremony,"
meaning all due caution.
"Understood," said Holguin.
An honour guard would receive the Iron Hands captain in the landing bay and in the hall leading from there. There would be full respect and full security. The lion accepted that the ship was the Sthalenus. After this long in these storm-wracked regions, so close to the maelstrom, there was no assurance that what walked the frigate was what it claimed to be. He waited until a thunderhawk pulled away from the Sthalenus. Then he withdrew to the ship's council chamber to wait. The hall was a large, solemn place, dimly lit as if jealous of its secrets. 6 iron chairs were placed in an arc around the lion's throne, 3 on each side, 1 for each voted lieutenant of the hexagrammaton. The circle took up the centre of the chamber and left a vast expanse of shadows between it and the walls. The banners of the 6 wings hung from the high dome. They were barely visible in the gloom, whispers of strength. They swayed with slow, deliberate movements in the ventilation currents. The lion took his throne, flanked today only by Holguin and Farith Redloss, voted lieutenant of Dreadwing. The chamber was a long march from the landing bay. By the time Calibus arrived, the Primarch had received a full security evaluation of the captain. He was who he said, and there was no taint of the warp around him. Calibus entered the chamber accompanied by 2 other legionaries. One was his sergeant, Raud. The other was a raven guard, Levanus. The lion was struck by the choice Calibus had made for his escort. The Iron Hands would not include the raven guard out of politeness. Relations between the 2 legions had sometimes become heated on Macragge. They shared the trauma of Istvan V, but the Iron Hands held the tactical decisions of Corvus Corax as being in part responsible for the death of Ferus Manus. Levanus's presence spoke to an unusual level of trust. The lion wondered about the length and cost of the campaign that had forged this kind of a bond. The appearance of the 3 legionaries suggested much. Their armour was as pitted and scarred as their ship. It was polished and clearly treated with honour, but the means to repair it were lacking. The cost of the war was also in Calibus's face. By the faint hum of servo motors, the lion could identify the captain's legs and right arm as bionic. That was no surprise. He had known Iron Hands who had even less flesh prior to Horus's treachery. But Calibus had lost more flesh recently, and it had not been replaced by the strength of metal. His head had suffered what looked like severe plasma burns. His hair and eyebrows were gone. His skull was mottled black and angry red. The flesh looked melted, and it shone as if varnished.
"Captain Calibus," the lion said. "Well met."
Calibus dipped his head forwards in respect.
"Thanks, Lord Johnson,"
His larynx was evidently still organic, though his vocal cords had been damaged. He spoke with a voice of stones rubbing against each other. Levanus said, "The sight of the strength of your fleet revives our hopes." Calibus grimaced slightly at the mention of hope.
"What forces do you have?"
the lion asked.
"The Sithelenus is all we have left,"
Calibus said.
"We have been hunting the enemy since Istvan V," said Levanus. "We have hurt the traitors, but over time..."
"It has been years," Holguin said, impressed and sympathetic.
"Does the Emperor yet live?"
Calibus asked.
"We believe so," said the lion. "We are making for Terra."
Calibus cocked his head.
"By way of Pandarax?"
"The size of our fleet does not change the difficulties of navigating through the warp," the lion said, his tone cold.
Calibus seemed to realize he had spoken disrespectfully.
"I had hoped your experience was different from ours,"
he said.
"You're right," the lion thought. "It was."
He waved the question aside.
"I misspoke. We seek the way to Terra. And what about the Sithelenus? Is Pandarax your hunting ground?"
It seemed unlikely. There were no warships in the wreckage outside the warp storm.
"No,"
said Calibus.
"We came hoping to find my brother Captain Atticus. We know his strike cruiser, the Veritas Verum, reached this system and made for the world of Pythos. We know he left at least once and carried out a raid that destroyed the Third Legion's battle barge, Calidora. That is the last evidence we have of him."
"Why do you think he would have returned here?"
"In our last communication with him, he was tracking an anomaly, one that made transmission impossible, but provided the mistress of his astropathic choir with unsurpassed awareness of the sector."
Calibus was clearly dissatisfied with his description.
"He knew little when we spoke. The effect seemed to be the reverse of the Astronomicon."
The lion nodded. After the Pharos, he found the concept easier to accept than Calibus did.
"You think he was successful?"
"He was able to ambush the Calidora and its escorts," Levanus said. "A single ship destroyed them."
"And you have heard nothing since then?"
"Nothing,"
Calibus confirmed.
"We expected that, as long as he was on Pythos, he would be impossible to contact. But there has been only silence since the Calidora. That was years ago. We can no longer be effective against the enemy, not with a single frigate. We have been unable to find any of our brothers, so we came here."
"Our choices have been reduced to desperate ones," Levanus added.
"That is true for us all," the lion said. "Have you found any sign of him?"
"No,"
said Calibus.
"Though that is hardly surprising, given that we cannot enter the system. The presence of wreckage outside the warp storm is curious, though. Atticus sent us the Veritas Ferrum's Auspex scans of Pandarax before communications ended. He did not encounter these ships."
"Do you know where they came from?"
"That is what we've been trying to determine. They are all civilian, antiquated, and appear to have been in poor condition long before they met with disaster here. Much of the wreckage we have examined shows signs of having been patched up repeatedly and badly."
"Have you boarded any of the hulks?"
"We had only just identified a few promising targets when your fleet translated."
"I see."
The lion thought about Tucholcha's words. "I have taken you where you must go." There was a confluence of too many events at Pandarax to be ignored. He did not trust Tucholcha, but it had never lied to him yet, at least not in any way he had been able to detect. He would act for now as if what it said was true.
"I cannot say if your captain is to be found here," he said. "I believe, however, that there is a secret here, one we must uncover."
"Somehow, Pandarax is the gateway to Terra."
"We will examine your target vessels with you, Captain."
Calibus nodded once, his acknowledgement curt but respectful.
"I did not think the task worthy of such resources."
It may prove to be vital, the lion said. The gold-plated double doors of the Exsultatio Angelae Librarium had been ripped from their hinges, and their engravings bubbled, the shapes of heroic war transformed into a nightmare tangle of insectile limbs. Plague demons stumbled down the aisles, their rotten swords hacking at books, turning them into liquefying pulp. In the centre of the great hall, there were other abominations. They were vortices of flesh and flame, headless cones of screaming mouths that breathed the fire of nightmare against the towering shelves. They whirled from lectern to lectern and rampaged through the marble bookcases. Vellum or data slate, metal or stone, whatever they touched burned and changed. The Exsultatio Angelae had been badly damaged in the red tears fall to Cygnus Prime. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, of irreplaceable tomes had been lost, swathes of the history of the Blood Angels and the culture of Baal swept into oblivion. Sanguinius regarded what had been salvaged as even more precious. These books were more than records now. They were survivors in their own right. Every scar and burned page a mark of the new chronicle and of the cost it exacted. Now they were dying, and worse. The corpulent monsters, their bodies leaking decay, were killing the memory of Baal, turning it into a rotten swamp. Fungus and mould sprouted on the spines of books at their passage. Tentacles and grasping fingers grew from the volumes. Data slates spread wings and flew about the wide central space of the librarium. Scrolls became tongues. They slipped off the shelves like long white slugs, babbling words that belonged to no tongue in the material galaxy. As they chanted, the air flaked into ash around them. A squad of Blood Angels, led by Sergeant Orexis, fought the incursion in the librarium. 2 5-man teams had taken up positions on opposite sides of the bronze-railed gallery that ran around the centre. They had a wide field of fire and were pumping bolter shells into demons on all 6 levels. Each shot was sniper-precise. They fired in short bursts, keeping firm control over the spread of their projectiles. They were trying to preserve the Exsultatio Angelae as much as purge it of the demonic presence. The angel swept his gaze over the first level of the Exsultatio and had to transmute despair into anger. The mutations were worse than the destructions. What had rotted was dying, already gone. What was changed was more insidious. On the first level, Sanguinius slashed the blade in carmine across the torso of a spinning abomination. Pale blue demon flesh parted, 2 halves of grotesquerie twisted away from each other, their mouths wailing anguish. The angel charged to the centre of the floor, wading deep into the spawn of the warp. Jawed arms snapped at him, unnatural flame washed over him, and he felt his bones try to change. He hurled the madness away. The destiny of his visions waited for him in the future. He was not going to fall here. Beneath the peak of the Exsultatio's dome, he paused. As Ralderon and the sanguinary guard formed a cordon around him, he struck the ground with the end of the Spear of Telesto's shaft, splintering a flagstone. The spear's blade glowed brighter and brighter.
"Put everything to the flame!"
Sanguinius ordered, his voice thunder over the din of battle. Ralderon looked at him sharply.
"Everything?"
"My lord," Orexis voxed, "we might yet save part of the archives."
"We have already lost them," Sanguinius replied. "We cannot know the full extent of the corruption. The changes we cannot see are the most dangerous. History altered is worse than history forgotten. The poison must be excised. Burn it. Burn it all." He fired the spear in anger, in anguish, and most of all in righteousness of purpose. Purity blazed magnesium bright. The beam sliced through clusters of whirling demons. Their babble turned into a choir of screaming distress, and then they were consumed. The blast took out 5 shelves at a stroke. Flame raced through the histories, the treatises, and the literature of Baal. The untouched and the corrupted alike burned. Ralderon's gasp was almost as subtle and as deeply felt. Ascalon's agony came through in the anger with which he ordered flamers deployed.
"Give me fire!"
he yelled.
"Give me flames as high as the dome!"
There was a desperate fury in his voice that was closer to the violence of Amit than Ascalon normally allowed himself to come. The sanguinary guard obeyed. Three of the legionaries stepped forwards with heavy flamers. Streams of burning promethium arced across the space of the librarium, igniting a firestorm around its periphery. They marched around the ring formation, gradually raising their weapons' nozzles, creating a spiralling conflagration. Demons lurched and danced through the blaze. They resisted the burn, but it devoured the archives before the warp flame could transform them further. The other Blood Angels sent mass-reactive hell into the fire. There was no more restraint now, and the full auto-bursts of shells shredded the monsters of disease and flux. From beyond the veil, the dark bell tolled and tolled, and its clamour sounded angry now.
"We defy you," Sanguinius thought, "and we deny you. Defeat is insupportable to you. You will come to know it well."
The bell tolled and tolled. The demons rushed the Blood Angels and fell back, rushed and fell back again. When their forms lost coherence and they could no longer fight, the fire burned their remains faster than they could deliquesce. The Exultatio Angeli descended into a tempest of devastation. Sanguinius hurled blasts from the spear without cease, mourning the knowledge and the art he destroyed, but made resolute by the necessity of what he did. The flames rose, and he was standing in the heart of a furnace. It roared, destroying what should not exist, bringing absolution to the tainted space of the Red Tear. In the midst of his sorrow and anger, Sanguinius sought the solace of victory. He spread his wings. They beat the air, sending smoke curling in violent eddies. He rose straight up through the rage of flame and battle until he reached the dome of the Exultatio. He wheeled around its circumference. The firestorm reached up for him, and he looked down at the struggle between his sons and the demons. At this height, the figures were small, yet the majesty of the Blood Angels shone brightly. They cut down the abominations with resolution and glory. There was anger in their attacks, but it was controlled, honourable. There was no sign of the bloodthirst. He saw only discipline. He saw his sons as they could be, as the best part of himself, and for a short while he could believe in the illusion that the floor was not just beneath the surface, waiting for its chance to erupt again. He gazed at the demons with contempt. There might always be new horrors for the warp to reveal, but the Blood Angels had the measure of these, and they would all be destroyed. "We have faced worse," he thought. "We have defeated worse." The loss of the librarium was a blow, but Baal still lived. The Imperium still lived. There was hope, and so the chance to rebuild, to create new art, new knowledge, new chronicles. He vowed there would yet be a new dawn, and from the peak of the dome he sent the beams of the Spear of Telesto stabbing down into the abominations, fueling the fire. The Exultatio's pyre blazed with purifying light. The shadow came for him. The immense weight on his hearts suddenly moved to crush them. "Mortis!" Sanguinius voxed, about to ask if the Red Tear had engaged the contact. But the darkness attacked before he could speak again. It was not a presence. It was the mere approach of the thing in the warp that hit, a bow wave catching him and drowning him. His wings folded under the blow, and he plummeted from the dome. He fell into the mouth of the fire vortex. Demons leapt for him, the mouths at the ends of their limbs snapping in hunger. Then they were gone, and he was falling in a blackness that was absolute, but not empty. Its substance knew him, and at a level beyond the conscious, he knew it. Before he could think what it was he recognised, the dark was gone. Sanguinius wasn't falling anymore, and he wasn't on the Red Tear. He was running down the hall of another ship. He knew this hall. He knew the tapestries that had once hung here. He knew the runes and monstrous carvings that had replaced them, and he knew what chamber waited at the end of the hall. He was aboard the Vengeful Spirit. He was about to enter Horus' throne room. He was going to fight his brother and die. This was no vision. It couldn't be. It was too real. He had no consciousness of his body being elsewhere. He heard the hammering thuds of his feet against the deck. He smelled the foulness of the ship's corruption. He felt his wounds. He was bleeding, and his armor had been damaged in earlier fights. He had slipped from time. The future had come for him, and the time of visions was finished. As Sanguineus closed in on the throne room, the red tear slipped away. Its reality faded and became a memory. The present was the vengeful spirit, and Horus was waiting. Sanguineus burst into the throne room. A colossus in black armor stood before him. There was a roar, and the chamber shook so hard it blurred. Then it was gone. Sanguineus was dropping through the firestorm of the Exaltatio Angeli again. He was not in the future. The roar had travelled with him, or it had summoned him back. It was louder than any of the explosions in the librarium. The red tear shook as the vengeful spirit had. A massive thrum rang the length of the hull. The dome of the Exaltatio cracked, and bookshelves 20 feet tall collapsed. Sanguineus spread his wings wide and held them rigid, breaking the speed of his descent. He regained control of his flight and landed in the center of the sanguinary guard formation. Above, the gallery was collapsing, the railing dropping into flame. Orexis and his squad jumped down onto the sloping wreckage and made their way to the ground floor, trapping the plague demons between them and the sanguinary guard. The roar came again, and a shudder that sickened Sanguineus. It was the mark of a profound wound to the red tear.
Mortis, report! The contact, Lord! It's hitting us! With what? Is it a ship? Unknown. But it's overwhelming the void shields. We're firing. No way to tell if we're causing any damage.
Sanguineus opened his mouth to answer. The roar came again, and the vengeful spirit forced itself onto his consciousness. He didn't believe himself to be on Horus's flagship this time. His perception flickered between the spirit and the tear, and when Horus's blade struck him, the intensity of the vision almost brought him to his knees.
This is a vision, he thought. Only a vision. It has no reality. Not yet.
He turned his spirits away from the experience of his death. The effort was so great the taste of blood flooded his mouth.
My lord!
Ascalon was at his side.
What is happening to you?
A psychic attack,
Sanguineus rasped. Giving it a name was necessary. It was a means of regaining control, the truth as Counter-Strike. He straightened.
We finish here, and we return to the bridge.
He had to see the enemy in the warp. He had to lead the struggle against it. His mind kept slipping back to the vengeful spirit. His mind, only his mind. He looked out upon the burning Exaltatio and focused his anger on what had been taken from the Blood Angels here. He held tightly to the loss he felt now, and the future's grip on his spirit slipped just enough. With the sanguinary guard forming a wedge behind him, he brought the final flames to the abominations in the librarium. As he fought, the shadow began to pull away. He saw more clearly. The oppression lifted, and the hull shudders ceased. When he turned from the ashes and smoke of the purified hall, he knew before he reached the bridge that the enemy had pulled away from the red tear. Carminus was speaking with Mortis when Sanguineus arrived.
"I'm sorry, Fleet Master," Mortis said. "There is nothing more we can tell. There is nothing."
"What is it?"
Sanguineus asked.
"Has the foe retreated?"
Carminus looked grim.
"It left us for different prey," he said. "The sable is gone."
The corridor heading towards the bridge of the Wordbearer's strike cruiser Annunciation was heavy with shadows. Walls, floor, and vaulted ceiling were black marble veined with crimson runes. Muzzle flashes lit the hall as the defenders were cut down. Two Wordbearers, slow to retreat, tried to hold back the destroyers, while the rest of their squad pulled back quickly up the corridor. Hierax's squad rushed them, each legionary wielding two bolt pistols. The hail of mass reactive shells punched through armor and blew apart the flesh inside. The traitors staggered and fell, blood splashing out behind them. Leading the charge, Hierax fired after the other traitors, alternating blasts with his pistol and his Volkite Serpenta. The shells cracked open one Wordbearer's helmet. The Serpenta's heat ray incinerated his skull. Flame burst from inside the helmet, followed by the cloud of ash that had been the legionary's head. The rest of the squad reached an intersection. As they turned off the main hall, one of them pulled a detonator from his belt. The corridor flashed white before Hyrax could shout a warning. A series of demolition charges blew out the sides of the vaulted ceiling. Tons of marble and ferrocrete crashed down. Hyrax threw himself back with his men. They were at the edge of the destruction and narrowly escaped being crushed. A chunk of the upper decking struck Hyrax's shoulder. It was a glancing blow, but still hard enough to smash him to the side. He hit the starboard wall and shattered the cladding. When the dust settled, Legionary Kletos said, "We aren't getting through that." The rubble blocked the corridor completely. The charges had gone off down a length of more than 100 yards. There was no point trying to punch through the wreckage with melter bombs. There was no corridor at all, only compacted decks. Hyrax cursed. His squad had moved fast since the 3 Cestus assault rams had struck the upper levels of the Annunciation's superstructure. He estimated they were a few 100 yards from the bridge. The strike cruiser had undergone dark transformations, but the layout of the decks was familiar enough. As close as he had come to the goal, though, he might as well be miles distant now.
"Apovos!"
Hyrax voxed the sergeant of the 2nd squad. "We're blocked. Tell me you have the bridge in sight." Hyrax and Apovos were leading attacks along parallel paths, port and starboard, direct runs straight to the bridge.
"Well, the word bearers just tried to drop a ceiling on us, Captain. We can't go any further in this direction."
The simultaneity of the demolitions made the tactics look less crude.
"Hold your position, Sergeant," Hyrax said. "We need to understand the trap they're trying to set for us."
He opened a channel to the 3rd squad, advancing 2 decks below.
"Gautier, has the enemy demolished your way forwards?"
"No, Captain. We've reached a sealed door. It's very large. From its markings, I believe there is a fane on the other side."
"Lorgar's wretched sons want to funnel us into their hall of worship," said Hyrax.
"Well, they want to bring the destruction of battle into their shrines?"
Apovos asked.
"More likely they think to make a sacrifice of us."
"Let them try," said a slow, grindingly mechanical voice.
Antal Sidas, the ancient Doradeo pattern dreadnought, marched with Gortia's squad.
"I think we will."
Hyrax looked again at the rubble.
"Gortia, I want the precise dimensions of the door and its wall."
"Do we make for his position?" said Apovos.
"No, stand by."
The trap was effective. If there were other routes to the bridge, it would take time to find them. Time the word bearers could use, and the Ultramarines did not have. The traitors knew the destroyers would have no choice but to enter the fane, where the ambush would be waiting. But if the hall was as big as Hyrax suspected it was, there was another option. Gortier relayed the data, and Hyrax compared it to what he knew of the deck plan of the superstructure. He couldn't know the length of the hall behind the door, though it was clear it ran parallel to the blocked corridors. More crucially, the fane appeared to be at least 3 decks in height. Hyrax turned to the starboard wall and punched it, breaking off more marble.
"Prepare melter bombs," he said. "We're going through this wall. Apovos, we're moving laterally. Break through the wall to port. Gortier, take the door on my signal. We'll make the ambush ours."
The bombs ate through the wall, turning stone and metal to smoking rivulets. The tunnel glowed with heat, and Hyrax had the impression of moving through the flesh of a living thing. The ship's hull groaned with the rhythm of the Annunciation's guns and the impacts of the Kavaskor's assault, but the walls here trembled too much like wounded muscle. The second set of melter bombs broke through to the other side of the wall.
"Go,"
Hyrax voxed Gortier.
"Hit them now."
He rushed forwards. He was prepared for the breach to be 40 feet up a vertical wall. Instead, it opened onto a high gallery. The Wordbearer's temple was larger than he had expected. His and Apovos's squads had entered 20 yards forwards of the main door, and the huge hall extended several yards to Hyrax's right. Its ceiling was another 50 feet up, and was ribbed, stained armour glass. The sick light of the ruin storm shone through, refracted into rays that touched on the altar and pews like the blessings of a corrupt god. The wide central aisle sloped upwards until the 4 doors, leading to the bridge, were 2 decks above the aft entrance. The altar stood 10 yards from the top of the slope. It was a massive slab of granite, etched deeply with designs that taunted the eye with the suggestion of squirming movement. Dried blood stained the engravings, and a huge eight-pointed star of iron surmounted the altar. A triforium ran the length of each wall, sloped like the floor. Hierax had to fight off a wave of vertigo as he stepped into the gallery before him. The fane felt more than oddly sloped. Its angles seemed to be adrift from the precepts of architecture, as if the space were floating in its own poisoned reality. Across from Hyrax's position, Meltabombs seared away the shadows of the Triforium's arches, and Abhovus's squad broke through. Aft, a massive explosion blasted the great doors off their hinges, and Antalcidas marched into the fane. He was a colossus in black. His sarcophagus bore the same grim colours as the armour of the destroyers. The blue of the 13th Legion was a splash on the pauldron, a vertical streak down the helm, a mark of honour and allegiance in the midst of the black. The destroyers were the company of war at its most brutal, the ultramarines of last resort, and their colours spoke of their grim purpose. Antalcidas fired straight ahead with his twin-linked Hellfire plasma cannonade at first, destroying the central aisle with the flame of suns. Then the word-bearers retaliated, and he turned his weapons up to the Triforia. The traitors had taken up positions in the arches and in the four corners of the fane. Had the destroyers entered as a single unit, they would have been caught in a withering crossfire. As it was, the word-bearers outnumbered the ultramarines 2-1, but Hierax and Apophis's squads disrupted the cohesion of the ambush. Antalcidas moved forwards, shaking the floor with his steps, weathering the bolter fire coming in from all sides, shielding Gortia's men. The word-bearers had only a few seconds for a concentrated volley. Then the destroyers were among them. Antalcidas took on the starboard side, sweeping the cannonade from the Triforium to the corner of the fane. Word-bearers and the structures of the hall alike melted and vaporized in the inferno. Gortia and his squad charged the traitors on the port side. Rows of pews exploded in the exchange of fire. Hierax and Apovos took their squads forwards, sending a steady barrage of bolter shells ahead of them down the narrow confines of the Triforia. The word-bearers' superior numbers did them little good here in the initial moments of the struggle. There was barely space for three legionaries to march abreast, and the traitors could not bring their fire to bear effectively on the intruders on the upper level. Hierax used the momentum of surprise, blasting through a full squad of the enemy. "This is for Kalth!" he snarled, pumping shell and flame through the head of another traitor. Then a huge shape barreled through the next line of word-bearers. Its armour still bore the insignia of the serrated sun chapter, but the ceramite had mutated to contain the form of a swollen monster. The legionary's hands had split his gauntlets and turned into huge claws. His face was inhuman, his mouth a raging beast's maw. Fangs as long as mortal's fingers parted as he attacked. He fired his bolt pistol past Hierax, blasting Kletos in the chest. He seized Hierax, his claws punching through the captain's armour, and swung him against an arch, slamming him through stone and suspending him over the drop. Hierax fired his serpenta into the word-bearer's face. The creature staggered back, roaring as flame engulfed his flesh. His claws convulsed, digging deeper into Hyrax's armour. Flesh burned through to bone, but the beast did not fall. He hurled Hierax against the far wall again and again, fighting now like a wounded animal, his eyes blazing with unnatural fire brighter than the flame that consumed his skull. Masonry crumbled around Hierax. Ferrocrete girders rammed into his back as the word-bearer drove him deeper into the wall. Beyond the monster, the clash between the destroyers and traitors was a maelstrom of chain blades, lightning claws, and power fists. Bursts of warring energy tore the gloom of the Triforium. Hierax tried to fire again, but the monster batted aside his pistols. The word-bearer seized his arms, pinning them to his sides. His armour began to buckle under the grip of the distorted talons. The light from the word-bearer's eyes now enveloped his entire body in a shimmering scarlet aura. The skull had shed all burned flesh. It was a howling death's head, animated by something utterly beyond the human. Kletos swung his chainsword against the word-bearer's back. Mechanized teeth ground through the armour. The word-bearer hurled Hierax down and whirled, striking Kletos a blow that knocked him back against the Triforium's balcony, then turned on Hierax again.
The destroyer was already on his feet. He slapped a melter bomb to the creature's chest plate. The fiery eyes flickered with dawning comprehension. The claws hesitated. Hyrax crouched low, and his auto-lenses clicked shut against the flare of the blast. Damage runes flashed warning as the heat washed back over him, further disintegrating the wall. The full force of the explosion went through the word-bearer. An inhuman thing shrieked. The sound took too long to fade, as if whatever had screamed were falling into an abyss beyond the materium. A pool of molten armour and charred fragments of bone lay where the word-bearer had been. Hyrax lunged out of the ruined wall, guns in hand once more. The death of the monster had killed another word-bearer, and the traitor's squad had retreated a few yards, laying down heavy suppressive fire. The forward's doors of the fane burst open, and reinforcements poured in. The destroyers had survived the ambush, but their advance was stymied.
"Venerable brother Antalcidas," Hyrax foxed, "two missiles to the forward doors. Destroyers, pull back and take cover."
The rockets streaked from the dreadnought's Aeolus launcher. Hyrax grinned tightly as they roared across the fane and exploded just past the altar, blasting the eight-pointed star to shrapnel.
"Burn," Hyrax muttered. "Burn, you treacherous scum."
The missile warheads were Phosphex shells. A cloud of burning mist erupted at the far end of the fane. Currents roiled within it as streamers latched on to the movement of the word-bearers. It crawled over them, covering them in the white-green flame. The cloud billowed down the central aisle and along the Triforia. It moved like a living thing, leaping and crawling over its prey. It burned armour, stripping it away layer by layer until it devoured the flesh beneath. The word-bearer's barrage faltered as the Phosphex cloud moved down the forward's half of the fane, a grasping hand of agonised death. The traitors tried to escape. Many stumbled blindly, human torches of chemical fire, and spread the horror with them. In the Triforia and in the central aisle, the destroyers formed a black wall. With bolter and plasma fire, they drove the word-bearers back into the Phosphex and cut down those who staggered out.
"Scorch this hall!" Hyrax ordered.
Antalcidas advanced, rotating left and right, blanketing the fane with cannonade fire. Legionaries from all three squads fired rad missiles into the cloud. Nothing could live in the forwards half of the fane. Hyrax's auto-senses tracked the spiking rad levels. The Phosphex cloud flowed closer, swallowing the last of the word-bearers, edging towards the destroyers. When the leading edge was less than 10 yards away, he spoke to the dreadnought again.
"Time to cleanse the battlefield, venerable brother. We still have to reach the bridge. All squads prepare for atmospheric voiding."
Antalcidas aimed the cannonade towards the ceiling and opened fire, vaporizing the armor glass. A gale shrieked upwards. Deprived of oxygen, the Phosphex burned itself out. Flames extinguished and smoke rushed into the void. The space of the fane became clear and cold, an irradiated waste of incinerated corpses. The doors to the bridge were still open. The ultramarines advanced as an impassable wall of black death.
"Burn everything that moves," Hyrax said.
"Not the controls?" Kletos asked.
"No. We have a use for this ship." The destroyers crossed the threshold and bathed the bridge with flame. They came at Gilliman with their dark blades. The word-bearer in front of Gilliman was an apostle of madness. The grey flesh of his face and clean-shaven skull was covered in a dense inlay of runes. The bones of his head were beginning to distort, sprouting growths that might develop into horns or into more eyes. Left hand outstretched, he unleashed a blast of warp flame at Gilliman's face and lunged forwards, bringing the Athane up to stab at the seam of the Primarch's armour beneath the arm. At Gilliman's back, he sensed the other attacker, springing to plunge the knife into the back of his neck. His mind raced ahead of the actions. The ambush was strong. The absolute certainty was injury. The absolute need was to avoid being hit by the Athames.
"Practical. Choose your wound."
Gilliman threw himself into the blast, turning his face to the side. His flesh burned and rippled. His skull rang like a bell. In the depths of the fire there was a voice, inhuman,
knowing, a speaker of blood and ruined fates, a whisperer of bones.
Your path is chosen.
Needle sharp, precise as doubt, the words sank into his mind. A sliver, shooting past his defences as surely as the De Profundis splinters had struck the Samothrace. Deep in the blaze, moving forwards, half-blinded by flames, Gilliman fired the arbitrator. In the same instant, the rear attacker slashed at his neck. The passage of the athame breathed against his skin, the nature of the blade so powerful, so toxic, he could feel its presence even through the pain of the warp fire. The apostle's primitive blade scarred ceramite and cut through layers of ablative armour. Gilliman's bolt shell struck. The apostle grunted in pain. Gilliman dropped below the flames and spun, thrusting within Kandor. The blade shattered the right poline of the other word-bearer's armour and punched into his knee. The traitor stumbled and threw himself back. The defensive move, trained into instinct, spoiled his opportunity for a suicidal second attack with the athame. Gilliman tore the gladius free of the word-bearer's leg and rose with his back to the wall of the splinter. The apostle, hit in the right pauldron and sent into a spin, recovered a few yards away. His arm hung limp, and he held the athame in his left hand now. The word-bearers hung back, a few paces on either side of Gilliman. He held them at bay, his attention switching back and forth between them. They were still fast enough that if he shot one, he would leave himself open to a suicidal attack by the other.
"Do you know us?" the apostle asked.
The markings on their armour were familiar. So was the distorted face of the apostle.
"Cor Vondor, then Fael Rebor," Gilliman said. "Good," said Cor Vondor. "You should know the authors of your fall."
Gilliman sniffed in contempt. "You are authors of nothing," he said. "You are messengers at best." Fael Rebor growled, but Cor Vondor looked past Gilliman to where the ragged end of the splinter marked where the unburdened had vanished, and he smiled.
"We are undivided," he said. "Chaos acts through us."
"Then it fails through you," said Gilliman. "Now let's be done. Hurry up and die."
"He doesn't realize he's already lost," Cor Vondor said to Fael Rebor.
The captain didn't reply, as if unconvinced. But then he charged with a speed and confidence that belied his wounded leg. He held the athame before him. Cor Vondor attacked at the same time. He hurled the athame at Gilliman's face. Gilliman read how they would move before they did. His counter was so fast it was as if he had attacked first. He crouched, and Cor Vondor's athame passed over his head. It buried itself in the wall. Gilliman fired a sustained burst into Fael Rebor's chest and head. The rapid concussion of shells blew his armour open like an eggshell. Still clinging to the athame, Fael Rebor took three more steps. He was dead after two. Gilliman whirled on Cor Vondor. Eldritch lightning crackled around the word-bearer's hands and head. Gilliman flung in Kandor. It thudded into the centre of Cor Vondor's forehead. The apostle went rigid. His lightning lashed out with his death spasm. It struck with flashing violet light. A bolt hit Gilliman in the chest. He bore it. He stood immovable until Cor Vondor's throes ended. The wind of escaping atmosphere shrieked through the ship. Bolters chattered at the corridor end of the splinter. To Gilliman, a deep silence had fallen. He holstered his weapons, then pried the athame from Fael Rebor's grip and jerked Cor Vondor's blade from the wall. He held a knife in each hand. They were unnaturally heavy. He stared at the dull black edges. He remembered the feel of another athame, its blade against his throat. Cor Feron had barely nicked his flesh, an insignificant wound. Gilliman had mocked Cor Feron for his error. Back then he had not placed much importance on the blade. It was Cor Feron's powers that had made the word-bearer dangerous. Analysis of the conflict after leaving Kalth had shown Gilliman his mistake. The knife had cut his flesh. It had drawn blood. But Cor Feron had not tried to kill him. He had tried to convert him.
"The truth will shock you, Rebute," Cor Feron had said. "Embrace this. This is the beginning of wisdom."
The athames were dangerous. Yet blades like the ones in his grasp had destroyed a powerful demon on Kalth.
Theoretical. The weapon of the enemy can be turned against him. Practical. He hesitated. So many unknowns getting in the way of evaluating risks and opportunities. Practical. Practical. Gilliman's Voxbeed buzzed, jerking his attention back to the immediate. He hadn't contemplated the athemes for more than a second or two. He flinched, guilty as if he'd been in a fugue state for hours. Althusser was on the Vox.
"We're in contact with the rest of the fleet," she said.
"Our ships?" Gilliman asked.
"Widely scattered but close, arriving from all directions."
"How long before they reach us?"
"Minutes."
"In no time at all, then." But no time would be what the Samothrace and Cavascore had once the bombardment began again.
Theoretical. The enemy is holding fire to facilitate my assassination. Once they know I am still alive, the attacks will resume.
Practical. Do not show yourself to the word-bearers. Let them think the struggle continues. Gain enough time for the fleet to arrive.
He made a conscious decision to consider the attack an assassination attempt. He refused to contemplate the idea of conversion.
He doesn't realize he's already lost.
He saved himself from introspection by considering how the gathering fleet should attack.
Practical. Use the advantage of our apparent weakness.
And then we are surrounding the enemy, Gilliman said.
Send the command to attack and engage as soon as the assaults can be coordinated. The fleet is a fist. Close it. Crush the foe.
So ordered.
Gilliman looked at the athemes and thought again about using the foe's tools for his own purpose.
Shipmaster, he said, what news from the Cavascore?
It engaged the strike cruiser Annunciation. Captain Hyrax's destroyer company boarded as you commanded.
Hyrax would leave nothing behind but ash. The Annunciation was a dead ship, even if the word-bearers aboard believed otherwise.
Signal Chapter Master Iasus, Gilliman said. Captain Hyrax is to take the Annunciation's navigators alive.
Understood.
Gilliman sheathed the athemes in his belt. He felt their presence as a cold pressure. He would store them securely as soon as he could. He drew his own weapons again and made his way back down the splinter towards the sound of battle. He stopped while he was still out of sight. He listened to his sons purge the traitors from the Samothrace. He was the light in the shadows, holding back, though instinct urged him to join the fight. The correct practical was to wait for the right moment, and then he would bring his avenging light to bear on the traitors.
What choice ever?
The wait was a short one.
The fleet is here, Primarch, Althusser voxed.
Begin,
Gilliman ordered. The Night Lords were the first to react. The World Eaters were too focused on the chance to destroy the Ultramarine ships before them, so consumed with frustrated anger that the Athame mission was taking so long, they barely noticed the first contacts on the Auspex array. The word-bearers' vessels, in the centre of the operation, realised what was coming sooner, but the concentration of the squadron around the Samothrace and the Cavascore slowed their manoeuvre to face the approaching threat. The Night Lords, already hanging back, took the first contact seriously. Their squadron turned away from the Samothrace immediately. The next contacts showed how big the threat was. Now the World Eaters reacted too. New contacts appeared with every second. Wise heads on each ship realized what was happening. They had known this was a possibility. They had trusted in the Prophet and the captain of the De Profundis to make the kill before now. The squadrons were stronger than the two ships they had trapped, but they were not a fleet, and it was a fleet that came for them. The Night Lords accelerated quickly. The strike cruisers, Vitam Mortem and Night Revelation, with the frigates Infinite Fall, Phosphine and Descent from Hope, did not look for a fight they could not win. They raced to translate into the Empyrean, while there was still time. The Glorious Nova fell on them, and with it the strike cruisers High Ascent, Cornucopia and Triumph of Reason, and almost a dozen frigates. At the command of the Glorious Nova, Captain Lucretius Corvo muttered thanks to the fates when he saw the Legion markings of the ships he was about to destroy. The streaks of hundreds of torpedoes carved the void with light, and every strike was an act of justice for the dead of Sotha. The Night Revelation was at the head of the squadron, pulling even further ahead. The Ultramarine's torpedo barrage hit it as its warp engines were spooling up to make the jump. Further back, the Vitam Mortem lowered its bow below the ecliptic, its angle with respect to the rest of the squadron becoming more and more steep. It was as close to an evasion as a vessel of its magnitude could muster. 73 torpedoes hit the Night Revelation in a matter of seconds. Its void shields collapsed immediately. The blasts that lit up the length of its hull fused into a single river of fire, a lava flow devouring the integrity of the strike cruiser. The warp engines went critical, and a sphere of unreality expanded from inside the hull. The shape of the vessel bulged, distorted and rippled as the shimmering bubble burst from its confines. The shimmer spread. The entire ship refracted fire and reality, a fragmenting mirror. Then it exploded. Ignited plasma and uncontrolled immaterium lashed out. The phantoms of the night perished in the heart of a new star. The killing light grew, and in its hunger it swallowed the infinite fall. The frigate's hull melted as it drove through the fireball, and then it too became part of the purging dawn. The Vitam Mortem went lower and lower yet, until it was running perpendicular to the plane of the squadron's flight. It sustained torpedo hits on its stern, and flames swept through its corridors, cutting off the engineerium from the superstructure. Primary power flickered. The void shields went down for a full 2 seconds, but then it was past the initial barrage and still accelerating. The Phosphine and the Descent from Hope tried to follow it. The High Ascent and Cornucopia took the Descent from Hope apart, moving forwards to trap the vessel between themselves, hammering it with batteries of cannons and macro lasguns. It hit back, punishing the larger ships on either side, but it took many times the damage it could inflict. It was a flaming ruin when it emerged from between the two ships. It moved off into the void, a crematorium for all aboard. On the bridge of the Glorious Nova, Corvo watched the Vitam Mortem's evasion. The Nova's course was changing to put it on a pursuit heading.
"Are you seeing the Craven flight?" he voxed.
Aboard the battle barge Magisterial, Chapter Master Empion of the Ninth answered,
"We are."
The Magisterial was only now coming into range of battle. The ship and its escort were approaching from the direction in which the Vitam Mortem sought to flee.
"The traitors are running into our teeth," Empion said.
The World Eaters did not try to run. Their formation attacked the Ultramarines as if the fleet had been drawn into a trap, and the traitors were not surrounded by a closing gauntlet. The strike cruisers, Bellatorus and Cruz, led the charge. They were up against the battle barge Gauntlet of Glory, the Grand Cruiser Suspiria Majestrix, the Chronicle, the Glory of Fire, and 20 more ships beyond them. The World Eaters fired all their forwards guns at once. The barrage was a roar of defiance that cut through the Chronicle. The cruiser became a cloud of ignited gas and debris, moving forwards on momentum. Its kin repaid the attackers in kind. The Suspiria Majestrix's Nova gun hit the cruise head-on. The blast split the ship in two, the halves parting like jaws, then peeling back from the gathering eruption. In the midst of the word-bearer's formation, the Annunciation turned against the flow of the retreat. It accelerated, as if it sought to escape from the cluster of ships. It had ceased to respond to hails shortly before the arrival of the Ultramarine's fleet. The Cavascore pulled away from it, and the Annunciation drove straight for the Orfeo's Lament. The light cruiser was still turning when the larger ship closed in on it. It abandoned its manoeuvre and tried to accelerate on a tangent. The Annunciation struck it just forwards of the stern. It broke the Lament in half. It barreled through the hull in a storm of explosions. Statuary from both ships, colossal embodiments of metaphor and the lessons of the dark, flew off from the collision in a swarm of tumbling fragments. The Orfeo's Lament howled its last, and the plasma cries swept over the Annunciation. The strike cruiser's bow was a ruin after the collision, twisted and fused. Tremors swept the hull, damage feeding damage, until the ship was a bomb awaiting the signal for detonation. The signal came from the Cavascore, when Hierax remotely triggered melter charges he and his destroyers had left behind. The raging holocaust grasped at the retreating squadron.
scraping the void shields, striking at the vessels with a foretaste of the 13th Legion's anger. The full measure of this wrath came from the Ultimus Mundi, and the Gauntlet of Glory, and the Praetorian Trust, and the Triumph of Espandor, and the Unbroken Vigil, and the Aquiline, and scores more. The fist of the Ultramarines closed with convulsive fury. Not a single ship of the Night Lords, the World Eaters, or the Word Bearers translated to the Immaterium. Overwhelming force turned them to fire, to ash, to the dissipation of gas, and to the silence of dust. Cold, devastating precision annihilated the warriors of terror and of rage. But when it came to the Sons of Lorgar, there was a shout that echoed on the bridges and in the halls and in the weapon bays of every ship involved in their destruction. "For Kalth!" went the cry. The Ultramarines' fleet had been reduced by that betrayal, yet it was still the largest of any legion. Many of the ships that had survived that day were present now. Their legionaries, hungry for victories and for justice, took their measure of revenge and rejoiced. "For Kalth! For Kalth! For Kalth!" Gilliman oversaw the extermination of the squadron from the bridge of the Samothrace. He stayed focused. He monitored every action and approved of the decisions of his sons. But the Athames pulled at him. When the last of the enemy ships were guttering torches, he returned to his quarters alone. He sealed the door. A 20-foot vault dominated the starboard wall. He opened it, revealing compartmentalized stasis chambers. He placed the Athames in an empty one, engaged the field, and stepped back. The air between him and the blades shimmered slightly. The vault door boomed when he shut it. Hexagramic circuits locked the vault down tight. It would open to him and no one else. The Athames were secured now. They were beyond doing harm. His hand rested on the wheel of the door. "Oh, they can be studied now," he thought. "Maybe they can be used." In the lower levels of the Samothrace, cells held the navigators captured from the Annunciation and transported by Thunderhawk from the Cavascor. They too might be used. Theoretical. The tools of the enemy, subverted from their purpose, can be among the most effective weapons against the foe. Theoretical. These tools may be dangerous in their own right. Any attempted use may invite disaster. His analysis was incomplete. He couldn't tell which theoretical was the most valid. What choice ever? He thought he heard the voice in the flame laugh. "He doesn't know he's already lost."